There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We've bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmandel, and I'm your host on today's program, 25 Years of Cutting Edge Public Access Television. I'll be speaking with Maria Juliana Bick from Paper Tiger TV, which is now celebrating 25 years in business. And she's been part of the production of a new documentary about Paper Tiger TV called Paper Tiger Reads Paper Tiger Television. You will want to stay tuned. Well, hello, Maria. Thank you for joining me today.
Oh, hello.
And you're down there in Austin, Texas, right? Not your usual New York home, correct?
Yeah, I'm in Austin for the NAMAC conference. So I'm calling you from a hotel room.
I thank you for making the time available. So to get started, why don't you tell me a little bit more about what Paper Tiger is and a little bit of history?
Okay. Paper Tiger Television is a volunteer video collective. And we started 25 years ago as a group of people who were really interested in using public access television to look at the media industry. And so we started off as a regular television show, usually a live broadcast, and we would bring in people who had interesting things to say about different media. And so a regular show would happen every week or every other week, and over, you know, the first few years, it became really well known in the both academic and alternative media circles. And so we were creating a show that a lot of people really liked. And after a few years, a lot of people were calling in and wanting to have our tapes. So we started sending tapes out across the country and really started a whole kind of little phenomenon of do-it-yourself media that really had a fun, funky edge to it, but also looked at the media in a critical way. And so that was 25 years ago, and over the years, you know, different people have joined the collective and have been interested in investigating different aspects of the media, and also have become more involved in social justice media. And so there's been a lot of really interesting programs and documentaries, short documentaries that Paper Tiger has made.
So you've expanded beyond just having the one program and are helping people learn how to make their own video and documentary work then.
Yeah, we do that in a lot of different ways. People join the collective for lots of different reasons. A lot of people are interested in learning production, and a lot of people who join the collective are also interested in kind of advocacy work or being more involved in a community organization and a collective environment. So we get all kinds of people, and as a collective, we're non-hierarchical, and we make decisions on a consensus basis. And so, you know, in that kind of environment, things are going to change a lot based on who's there and who has interesting projects that they want to work on that other people want to work on as well. So, yeah, in the last few years, we've done a lot more kind of documentary style, more edited and produced than the early shows, which were really kind of live and spontaneous. And so it's just, you know, it depends on who's there and what the interests are and what's happening out in the world that the people in the collective feel is an interesting thing to investigate.
Now, would you say the change in what Paper Tiger has produced also sort of mirrors a bit of the technological changes since, you know, certainly in the 1980s, we didn't have digital nonlinear editing equipment. It was took a little bit more esoteric skill and maybe access to technology to produce television than it does now in a certain way.
Yes, definitely. I think when Paper Tiger first started, the only thing that was really out there in terms of national media was the three major networks. And so what Paper Tiger did at that time was try and create, you know, a complete alternative to that environment. So what we did was spontaneous and non-scripted, and had gave people a lot of time to talk. It wasn't the soundbite culture at all. It was kind of giving someone half an hour to investigate one issue in depth, and also really kind of interesting ways of using the media. We had a very distinct aesthetic that was obviously not part of the corporate mainstream media, and that a lot of our graphics were handmade, and we had a cranky, which was a homemade little crank that would scroll, you know, the credits and information instead of anything computer generated, and it gave it this real kind of handmade, accessible feel that I was designed. It was both kind of out of necessity, but it was also a statement that, you know, making media doesn't have to be an elusive and, you know, highly produced process. It could be something that is done spontaneous and is done with a group of people who are really committed. And so in that way, it not only was the content different in that we were looking critically at the media and approaching things in a much more in-depth fashion than the mainstream media usually does, but we were also creating a whole other look for, like, what TV could look like. So, and then when, handheld equipment became more attainable, you know, in that it wasn't as expensive and a group of people could buy a camera or something, then people started, you know, thinking about hitting the streets and getting out and doing more documentary-style work. And so we did a lot of pieces that documented social actions, the labor strikes in Pittston, labor strike, and also the Tompkins Square Park demonstrations when counteracting the gentrification that was happening in New York, and lots of other kind of social action that often isn't fairly or accurately or represented at all in the mainstream media. Paper Tiger would take the cameras and document the perspectives and the social justice movement on the streets. So that's been a lot of what Paper Tiger has been involved in. And then also just looking critically at new and interesting things that are happening in our media environment. And so that's always been a thread that's tied together a lot of the work that Paper Tiger is interested in doing.
And you said in the early days, you know, it started out that you were primarily, you were on in New York City, Paper Tiger was, and then you started to send videotapes out. And and then Paper Tiger got onto other channels or other public access channels as well?
Yes. Yeah. A lot of people, it was in the, you know, beginning days of public access. So there was, you know, a lot of these, you know, communities had TV stations, but they didn't have a lot of programming, so it was kind of the ideal time for an organization like Paper Tiger to come in and, you know, produce stuff that I think a lot of people across the country felt was really interesting and fun, and also, you know, we would provide it free of charge for people to broadcast on their public access stations. So, we through that process began to connect with a lot of the other organizations across the United States who are interested in media reform and alternative media production. And I think in a lot of ways it was the beginning of the network that kind of culminated in Seattle at the WTO protests and kind of, you know, spurred on this whole alternative media movement. There were groups across the country that were interested in producing Paper Tiger production. So we started off in New York, and then there was a group that sprung up in San Francisco and one in San Diego, and different cities also, you know, produced Paper Tiger, and also internationally, Paper Tiger aesthetic and kind of idealism or philosophy was also very popular. So people from around the world kind of looked at it and tried to emulate it in certain ways, and also we would partner with them on productions when it seemed to be a good idea.
And because you, Paper Tiger is a collective and decentralized in a way, I guess it was easy for people to join in and for the idea to grow without there having to be you know, some very centralized organization calling the shots.
Exactly. And I think that that's something that I feel is, you know, part of the future of Paper Tiger, is that now there are so many, you know, Paper Tiger was an early advocate for do-it-yourself media and everybody being a media maker. And now everybody is a media maker, you know, with their cell phone, you can make videos, or, you know, with your camera. And so a lot of people are media makers now. And I think Paper Tiger is, hopefully we're thinking about, you know, getting into a position where we can become a place where people are interested in producing Paper Tiger type productions, that we can be kind of a hub for that kind of work, and to continue our leadership in the field, but also to nurture, new and interesting approaches to using the media as a tool for creating community and creating better citizens and more active and artistic and, you know, critical looks at our social condition.
And you are listening to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. Today I'm speaking with Maria Juliana Bick, who is a collective member and a staff person. She manages distribution and other administrative tasks for Paper Tiger Television, which is celebrating its 25 years of producing cutting-edge public access television dedicated to issues like social justice and critical analysis of our media environment. You can check out Media Geek online at www.mediageek.net and the radio shows at radio.mediageek.net. If you have any comments or questions about the program, send them to me, paul@mediageek.net. So let's talk a little bit about the new documentary that you've had a hand in helping to produce, Paper Tiger Reads Paper Tiger Television. It's a great title. It's very very obvious about what it covers. What sort of was the motivation to put together the documentary, and what's in it?
Okay, well, first, the title is kind of a play on a lot of the early shows that were, you know, the title was often the name of some academic or a media analyst or social activist reading a media text. And so the idea was that they were doing kind of an in-depth reading of Glamour magazine or of the 6 o'clock news or of the New York Times. And so that was kind of harkening back to the olden days when somebody would kind of sit in a yellow chair and deconstruct a piece of our mainstream media. So that's where the title comes from. And it's really, you know, an attempt to tell the story of Paper Tiger, because when I joined the collective, I had heard about Paper Tiger as this, you know, really interesting organization in New York that did work that was very much in line with the kind of work that I'm interested in and the ideas that I'm interested in. But when I joined, it was not clear, like, you know, the history and where did it all come from and what, you know, kind of the mission or the kind of ideals that had shaped Paper Tiger into what it was today. So I thought it was kind of a personal exploration at first to kind of tell the story, but it turned out that it really seems like it's a great piece that tells the story of how a group of people came together and took different ideas and an opportunity, you know, a new opportunity in the media environment, and created something that was really kind of revolutionary and pioneering and really, you know, spoke to a lot of people and was very influential. So I think that I was really interested in knowing, like, what created Paper Tiger, and I think it was good ideas at the right time, creating something that there was an audience for and a niche for. And now I'm realizing that, you know, the media environment is always changing. And right now we're in a completely different media environment, in that, you know, when Paper Tiger started, there was 3, you know, broadcast television networks. Well, now, you know, everybody's broadcasting, you know, everybody's a broadcast network of their own. And so it's completely different place to be creating media, but I still think the ideals of combining art and activism and analysis and creating it in a community setting is still a really important model. It's just going to look different. So I think that we're seeing it as an opportunity to open a dialogue to what does creative, innovative, kind of groundbreaking, pioneering media look like in today's media environment. And that's why I'm really excited about, you know, the documentary, because I think it's a chance for people to you know, think about how the media can be used. And because it is a tool, and it's a really powerful tool, and it's a great way to bring people together, and it's a great way to, you know, put people into action. And so I think that it's going to be a great tool to get some creative juices flowing and some new interesting stuff happening.
So it's not just a historical document, a story of some great thing that once existed. It's a story of something still moving along.
Yeah, that's, you know, the hope that, you know, we're moving into the next 25 years, mm-hmm. and it's going to be, you know, just full of surprises and innovation and, you know, lots of different creative people coming together and doing something that makes sense and is good and fun.
And so, people seeing the documentary, what will they see? I mean, what's your narrative?
They will see a lot of different collective members and a few kind of media historians and critics talking about Paper Tiger and how it all started, and talking about the collective collaborative model and how we create productions, which is really different from mainstream media and a lot of media, and that it's non-hierarchical. Mm-hmm. And they will also see a lot of old funky footage from the early days and get a taste for the kind of productions we've been doing over the last few years. So, and we have some, you know, some great little animations and some little video shorts, and it's kind of a big medley of all kinds of fun stuff and interesting kind of insights to what the collective is all about, and kind of a look at a lot of the different faces of who's been involved in Paper Tiger over the years. There's a lot of really amazing people who have walked through Paper Tiger doors and have been, you know, really active, and people have gone on to be, you know, artists and activists and scholars, and, you know, there's a lot of really amazing people who are Paper Tiger people now and people who were involved in Paper Tiger, you know, 25 years ago. So there's a lot of old footage that I think really great to see. And, yeah, so that's what they'll see.
And I'm really excited to see it myself. Where will this documentary be playing?
Well, we're kind of trying to plan a national tour, and we're going to be screening it wherever people want to see it. We're I'm in Texas now. I'm showing it here. I've showed it at the University of Texas to a few classes. It's going to be showing in Seattle on Tuesday, and it's showing in Columbus, Ohio at the Wexner Center right now, and I'm planning, you know, a Southern California tour, actually, in February, and we're really, you know, looking at art museums and arts organizations and universities and alternative media centers and public access stations, because all these people, you know, Paper Tiger is kind of a combination of all those things, and I think that's one of the strengths of Paper Tiger. It's not one thing, it's a lot of things, and it's a lot of things to different people. And so I think it has its place in a lot of different organizations. So, and if people want to find out where it's playing, we're going to, you know, keep things on our website so they can visit our website at papertiger.org. And we also have a vlog, which you can access through the website, which has a little trailer of the documentary, as well as some other work that we've been working on more recently. And we're really looking to the internet and our vlog as a way of doing Paper Tiger productions. We're still thinking about doing studio shows and maybe even moving back to the live shows. But the vlog is kind of our place where we've done some recent work that I think is... it's been really successful. I don't know how much more time I have. We did post a video there on the change in the postal rates. Mm-hmm. And just recently found out that it was seen by the Postal Commission. And so, you know, it, like we just put it on our vlog, and all of a sudden, you know, the policy decision makers in Washington, D.C. are watching our video that's, you know, kind of critical, its approach they've taken for setting the postal rates, which are going to affect a lot of small alternative publications and kind of not affect the huge corporate publications. But most of the cost of the postal rate changes is going to affect these small, independent, alternative magazines and zines, which, you know,
right,
in a democratic media environment is not really, shouldn't really be happening. So we're starting to use our vlog as a way of kind of getting some critical media reform issues out in front of a larger audience and hopefully reaching the right people that way.
Yep, the new technologies is not obsolete what you're doing. It just gives you new audiences and new ways to get it out there.
Yeah.
I'm really hoping I get a chance to see this documentary soon. Glad that Paper Tiger is still going strong after all these years. I've admired Paper Tiger for a very long time. And thank you very much for joining me, Maria Juliana Bick from Paper Tiger Television.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And I'll be back in just a moment with some news from our media environment. You're listening to Media Geek. Well, the battle against fake news took a new turn this week when the FCC levied $76,000 in fines against two broadcast companies because they failed to inform viewers that columnist Armstrong Williams was being paid by the U.S. Department of Education for his remarks made on their stations. In 2003, Williams secretly signed on with the department to promote No Child Left Behind in exchange for $240,000. He did not reveal this quid pro quo in his subsequent media appearances. $40,000 of the fines go to Sunshine Family Television Incorporated, licensee of WBPH-TV in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, for airing 5 episodes of, quote, The Right Side with Armstrong Williams. Sinclair Broadcasting, one of the largest owners of TV stations in the country, was hit with $36,000 for airing an episode of America's Black Forum in September 2004, which also included Williams talking about the legislation. Sinclair owns several TV stations in Media Geek's backyard of Central Illinois, including WICD TV 15 in Champain and WICS 20 in Springfield. The FCC says these appearances by Williams constitute a violation of sponsorship identification rules because Williams' financial relationship was not revealed. For its part, Sinclair told the FCC that the company was not aware of Williams' deal with the Department of Education. The commission responds that the fine is justified because the program Sinclair aired was provided as a complete production by Williams, and therefore Sinclair was at least obligated to identify that fact. The FCC's investigation was spurred on by a complaint filed by the media reform group Free Press, along with thousands of additional public complaints. In other FCC news, it looks like the effort to relax media ownership rules isn't dead. It's just sleeping. While the Kevin Martin-led FCC has put a nicer face on its review of media ownership rules than it did under Michael Powell by holding multiple public hearings on the issue, that doesn't mean Martin is any less driven to deliver an early Christmas present to consolidation-driven big media. Martin is reported to be circulating a version of new rules that would greatly relax the newspaper TV station cross-ownership restrictions, and that he's pushing to wrap up the rulemaking by mid-December. The problem with that timetable is that public comments on the FCC's research reports are due the last week of October, and reply comments are due mid-November. That doesn't really give the commission much time to review the thousands of comments from the public before Martin hopes to have the new rules voted on. It's actually a very rare thing that the FCC is only a month or so after the last comments are filed to make a ruling, and it's even rarer to happen on such a politically important subject as media ownership. The decision that Martin is pushing for has the potential to devastate the diversity of news reporting in most cities and media markets. By allowing the co-ownership of TV stations and newspapers, the number of independent newsrooms will dwindle, greatly impacting the number of local stories that get reported on. Major media companies like Tribune have been begging for this change for years. Tribune especially is really depending on it to seal the deal on its sale to Chicago financier Zell Miller, worth billions of dollars. And that's because the company's grandfathered exemption of the co-ownership rule for the Chicago Tribune and Chicago's WGN-TV are under review as part of the sale. But it's hard to believe that any media giant will be able to resist the cost-cutting benefits of combining and cutting TV newspaper staffs, despite whatever empty promises they'll offer the FCC and Congress. Congress is already weighing in on the news of Martin's push strategy. Democrat Senator Byron Dorgan and Republican Senator Trent Lott sent a letter to the FCC chair telling him that they do not believe the FCC, quote, adequately studied the impact of media consolidation on local programming, end quote. They further argued that, quote, the FCC should not rush forward and repeat mistakes of the past, end quote. Even pushing against the wishes of congresspeople from both parties, it's likely that Martin can count on support from the majority Republican commissioners. However, it's rarely politically advantageous to pass a major regulatory change with just a 3-2 vote. Some sort of concessions will probably have to be made to the commission's two Democrats, who both have been strong critics of relaxing ownership regulations. And as Media Geek has been doing ever since the show started in 2002, I'll keep you posted on what's going on at the FCC and how that has enormous potential to affect our media environment nationally and locally, the diversity of news we receive, and the number of voices that are represented within that news. So I do urge you to stay tuned. And coming up next week on Media Geek, we'll be talking again about a little bit of documentary filmmaker. I've scheduled Jill Friedberg to come on the next edition to talk about her documentary, A Little Bit of So Much Truth, or Un Poquito de Tanta Verdad, which is about the uprising in Oaxaca that has happened over the last 2 years, the people's movement known as the APO, and how they have seized the use of many forms of media, including radio and other forms, in helping to press the case of the people, especially the poor indigenous people of Oaxaca, against their governor, who they say was completely and utterly undemocratically put into power in that state in Mexico. That's in the next edition of Media Geek. So I think you do indeed want to come back and listen and stay tuned. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with another half-hour look at independent and grassroots media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. In the meantime, check out the frequently updated Media Geek blog at MediaGeek.net. The program can also be downloaded at Radio.MediaGeek.net, where you can subscribe to the podcast. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, and is heard on 10 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, WYQZ in Warrenton, Bealeton, Virginia, KWMD Kasilov in Anchorage, Alaska, WVEW in Brattleboro, Vermont, and Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. It's also on the web at Free Radio San Diego, Pirate969.org, and RadioDriftless.org. Media Geek is free to air on your local non-commercial station, too. Just email Paul at MediaGeek.net. That's also where you can send comments about the program, Paul at MediaGeek.net. Thanks for tuning in.